I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series, 10 lectures every season, and we are pretty far along in the season. We have two more to go. We end on April 21st with the artist Laurie Simmons. Next week, Senia Nahafi, Editor-in-Chief of Cabinet Magazine and Editorial Director of Cabinet Books, is here to speak on Gordon Mata Clark, who is, of course, represented in the Modern's current exhibition, Framing Desire, that I hope you've all seen. We are fortunate enough to have some new acquisitions by Gordon Mata Clark. So I've invited Senia to come and talk about an exhibition that he and his partner at Cabinet Magazine put together. He's curated a number of exhibitions and co-curated a number of exhibitions, including this particular project, which is titled Odd Lots, Revisiting Gordon Mata Clark's Fake Estates. And for this Tuesday evening, he will present the intricacies of Mata Clark's Fake Estates, which is a project that did not come to fruition due to the artist's death, and then Cabinet Magazine's 2005 response to that with an exhibition. It should be extremely interesting. I can't even emphasize enough how interesting I think this is going to be. I invite you to read more about it online. There's a description on the Modern's website, and then, of course, you can find anything on the internet, so explore as you will. And then most of all, I hope you can come back to get the full story next Tuesday. Tonight, we could not be more thrilled about the conversation planned between Mario Garcia Torres, J.D. Wittenberg, and Allison Hurst. Of course, Mario Garcia Torres is the artist featured in the Modern's upcoming Focus exhibition, which opens to the public this weekend, and is the reason for this Tuesday evening presentation. Mario is a conceptual artist based in Mexico City. He received an MFA from CalArts and has developed an impressive career with international acclaim for his ambitious, research-heavy, reflective work that addresses ways in which art and information are constructed over time as he examines, conflates, and reimagines conceptual art of the 1960s and 1970s, often focusing on stories less told or projects unrealized. For such work, Mario has been included in almost every major international show of recent years, including the Berlin Biennale of 2014, Documenta 13 in 2012, the Biennale de Sao Paulo in 2010, and the 52nd Venice Biennale in 2007. His work has been the subject of solo exhibitions in impressive locations across the globe, including Project Arts Center in Dublin, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, the Joan Miró Foundation in Barcelona, the Kunsthal Zurich, the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, and most recently his solo exhibition at the Hammer Museum in LA, which just closed in January. J.D. Wittenberg is a native Texan currently living in Dallas. He has written music and performed throughout the DFW Metroplex for more than 15 years. Beginning with a band in high school, J.D. released his first album in college. His 2007 self-titled album, J.D. Wittenberg, was nominated by the Dallas Observer for Best Album of the Year in 2007. J.D. never intended to get involved in conceptual art until his friend, local gallery owner Aaron Cluley, put him in touch with Mario Garcia Torres. The work to be discussed tonight is the second project they have collaborated on, and they are currently discussing plans for their next collaboration. And, of course, I think you all know Allison Hurst, the Modern's own assistant curator, who is in her tenure, has brought us the likes of Focus Fred Tomaselli and Focus Jules de Balancourt, and now is responsible for the upcoming exhibition, Focus Mario Garcia Torres, and thereby is responsible for this presentation. So a big thank you to Allison and a warm welcome to Mario Garcia Torres and J.D. Wittenberg.
Mario, I wanted to first start off and talk about your work in general. Although you work using a variety of media, your work always shares a common thread in that you somehow reference obscure and specific projects to important artists of the 1960s and 1970s, for the most part. Some examples you have referenced in one way or another include the Japanese conceptual artist An Kuwara during his 3-year stay in Mexico City, Daniel Berens' murals at a resort in the U.S. Virgin Islands, Boetti's proprietorship of a hotel called the One Hotel in Afghanistan. And in this, specifically what relates to your focus exhibition, Robert Smithson's projects in Texas. Can you talk about your work in general, how you relate to history and how you became interested in conceptual art?
Yeah. Hello. Good afternoon. Where should I start? I've had many responses to this, and I feel like, you know, from years to years, I kind of keep changing that answer, and I keep sort of negating myself, and then getting myself in more problems. But the latest response that I have to that is that when I started going to school, I first went to school in Monterrey, in a place in the north of Mexico, and back then I had this sort of I think now very naive and very stupid idea that was that I didn't want to share myself as a person. And I started thinking, like, how could I create a work of art that didn't involve myself as a person? And that was because I thought, you know, why would people care about my persona? What do I have to share in order to, like, for to be so important that people should care about? And not that I fully think that now I have anything interesting to say about my persona, but now I think I feel like my persona is more and more involved in the work. But back then I went through school, and in that school and sort of the people who were the main people who were sort of visible in Monterrey in museums and schools were mostly sort of people who still had a very kind of very romantic and very 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 bohemian notion of an artist, and most of them were kind of late abstract expressionist painters who cared about gesture and emotions and how do you express that in a canvas, and I was really like, that's not what I want to do. And not only that, but now I was in a big problem, which was how can I justify what I want to do. So early on, I think that question kind of coincided with the first revisions and the first publications that brought up conceptual art. And, you know, as some of you might know, that, you know, conceptual art from the 60s, I mean, from the late 60s, when those ideas, sort of conceptual ideas, were brought about, very few people saw the works. Very few people went to galleries and experienced those works firsthand. And in the early 90s or mid 90s, it was the time when people started reviewing that. And I feel like I am part of a generation that got where the first, we were young when those revisions were happening. So basically I spent a lot of time in the library, and suddenly I discovered this thing called conceptual art, and I thought, you know, this is great, because then I can go back to my professors and say, look at this stuff, and so I could sort of justify what I wanted to do through that. So lately I started thinking that maybe that sort of started my interest, and I feel like throughout the years what I've been really doing is trying to find sort of mind-like people, like even people who might be not around anymore, people who might have lived in a different time, people who I might have not even been able to do, but in a way, through the work and through research, I've been trying to identify myself with that. And I feel like that's sort of my interest in research and researching those sort of stories that sometimes are not told in history books are what brings me to them. So I don't know if that's a response.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about this project?
You mean the Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
This project was about
can you back up and talk about the inspiration that led to this project?
Yeah. I mean, this is a piece. It's a project that sort of generated a number of works that little by little. It's a kind of research that sort of went through, I don't know, a number of years, 7-8 years, little by little. I was researching on the fact one specific piece of information that intrigued me very much, which was the fact that Alighiero Boeria, an artist from the 70s, from the Povera Italian movement, had a hotel in the 70s in Afghanistan. And from many years, I read this line that said that. But information never got much farther than that. There was a couple of lines that said that the hotel was in a street named Chicken Street, and that he had a partner, and it never went farther than that. So I was really curious, and I feel like a lot of my interest in history is also about, not necessarily about the characters themselves, but about how sort of a kind of mythological figure came about. How does history is constructed, how history is played, and how those figures and those stories become a canonical thing, and why do we have this kind of intrigue? And of course, I discover many things throughout. And so, but the
so not on Allison's question, sorry. About this project.
Yeah, exactly. So now I'm going to start. No, I need to answer your question. And when I started the project, really, it was because I was actually living in California in the United States, and I was very much in disagreement with the war that was happening in Afghanistan. And I felt like in a very weird position to think, how can I say something about this, but at the same time being an immigrant in this country? And so at some point I figure out that in a very poetic term, I could talk about that situation through the story of Boeti in Afghanistan. So the first piece I made around this thing was actually a film treatment that pretended to describe a story where I was going to Afghanistan, and I was looking for the one hotel that actually the actual artist, Alighiero Boeti, had said that it had exploded. So the idea of disappearance and the idea of a faraway place sort of took about, and I tried to sort of describe how even the reasons for a war had disappear throughout the years and throughout the war. So anyway, it's a very long story, and which ended up in me actually after 7 years actually realizing that very same treatment script I had written in the US. And I went to Afghanistan, it was because I got invited to Documenta, and Documenta had the specific institutions to manage to have somebody actually go to Afghanistan, look for the place, and we found the place. And not only that, but we took over the place, and for a year we restored it, and I invited people from Afghanistan to come to the hotel, and I told why I thought this place was important for me and why it was important for Western history. And when the show in Germany, Documenta, finished, we released and gave back the house to its owner so that it could sort of continue its own history. Mm-hmm. So it was a way to figure out my, I feel like the last and most important gesture to me in that sense was how to took over and recognized it through caring about a place, which something interesting happened to me, and then releasing it again to be part of history again, to a different history.
Mm-hmm. Mario, I feel like when somebody asks you about one of your projects, you always insert the line, "It's a very long story." Would you say that's pretty much the case?
Yeah,
it certainly has been with us.
Yeah. I mean, I should first introduce you. Actually,
no, it's okay. This keep going. We'll talk about me later.
What am I going to say? No, I should
go for it.
You're going to move on to something. Well, to directly move on to your project here, which came out of an early collaboration with JD, your focus exhibition here at the Modern specifically relates to Robert Smithson and his projects in Texas. Smithson is arguably best known for the Spiral Jetty, which is seen here. It's a 1,500-foot-long spiraling landmass that jettisons out into the Great Salt Lake. During the time Robert Smithson made the Spiral Jetty, he also worked on two lesser-known projects in Texas, plans for the DFW airport, which were never realized, and also the Amarillo ramp, which was realized after his death as he died in a plane crash while surveying the site in preparation for the piece. So I just kind of wanted to ask you what first drew you to Smithson and specifically Smithson's projects in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, that long story started really some years ago, and that story came about because at some point, I don't know how much time ago, but at some point I realized that, I mean, I had read Smithson, and of course I very much appreciate a lot of his work and his writings mainly, and at some point I realized that in every picture, again, like the same way that Boetti had intrigued me in that sort of faraway adventure, I thought Smithson also sort of history had been written in a kind of similar way in that sense, in the fact that Smithson was a character that was an artist from New York, or that mainly lived in the art world, in the New York art world, but nevertheless was always going to a faraway place, going to the desert to do his work. And of course, he became very one of his most important proposals in our history is the fact that he was doing work outside in the land, and sort of, you know, became important in that. How he constructed what later became known as Langnard. And not only I was appreciated that, but the fact that he was always sort of creating a very specific character, or history had built a specific character, which was this cowboy going out in the land. So most when you look at Smithson's photographs, you see that he's wearing a cowboy hat and a pearl snap shirt, and so very early on I started thinking that, well, that story of an artist going out to the West, and not only that, but actually dying in his doing his work almost like a soldier, I started asking myself, how could I tell this story, and how could I retell this story where that says something. So I started writing a lyrics to potentially make that a country song. And that's when I met J.D. Wittenberg, which we have here. And at some point, somebody invited me in Dallas to participate in an exhibition. And I said, well, what I think could be have any kind of resonance in Dallas could be this thing that I think should be produced in Dallas. I have no idea how to make a country song, but I have these lyrics which could potentially become my collaboration to this exhibition at Dallas Biennial. I started talking to the curator, and through Erin Cluley, which is here with us, and we ended up talking to JD, which should get a better introduction. But before that, I should say that it was very important for me when I when I started doing that, to figure out not only the fact that I was talking about Smithson and talking about Texas, but also thinking that I needed somebody local to translate my thoughts. And I feel like that was, I should say that JD, we collaborated a lot in sort of shaping up the lyrics of the song, which he ended up singing and producing musically and composing. But the fact that I feel like my artistic gesture was really to figure out the way to tell a story to a specific people through their own subjectivity. How could I go to a place and check in with somebody who knows the language and tell him, listen, I have this story to tell. How could we collaborate to make it? How could you translate that into that very specific song? And I feel like that's precisely why I have invited JD here tonight, which is the fact because I sort of wanted to touch base again after a number of years and say, JD, now I have a show which continues this story and which we can talk later, but the fact that I need you again to come and translate that and translate each other for this in this context. And that's why I've asked JD to be here. I'm very honored that you're here.
Thanks, Mario. It's nice to be here with Mario. We've had a good time working together over the years. And just to be clear, the music that we worked on is a part of the film and the exhibition that's here this week. Mario, I think what impressed me the most is, songwriting is often differentiated from art. But what we do is very personal. At least what I do as a songwriter is very personal. And so when I was approached with the challenge of working with Mario on this project, I didn't realize it at the time what was happening. But I accepted the challenge because I thought it was interesting. Looking back now and looking at Robert Smithson, and I'm going to assume that there's a baseline knowledge of Robert Smithson with this crowd, but disregarding that, I'm going to go back a little bit and just say Smithson would take. He started out regionally. He would. New Jersey is a beautiful state. It's not the Garden State for no reason. And he would, he and his wife would load up these, objects, boulders, sand, what have you, from various parts of the state, bring them back to the galleries and create these non-sites, as he called them. And I have to admit, initially I thought that was kind of a bogus concept. But in working with Mario, I realized kind of after the fact that what in fact he did was create a non-site in our first iteration of this project together. And what that entailed was Mario coming to me with his concept. So these are the materials that he had to use for his non-site, right? It was Mario's concept. It was a general description of the musical, how he wanted it to sound. He did come with some lyrics or, an outline of how he wanted the song to, what he wanted to say. And that included some biographical information about Robert Smithson, his works, as much as possible, geographic locations, specifically Amarillo, New Jersey, Passaic, and New York City, and ultimately the way he passed away. So as a musician, singer, songwriter who tends to write from personal experience, this was a unique challenge, and I, the way it took shape was we very definitely collaborated on this song. He was in, thank God for modern technology, or this would have taken 10 years. We were IMing back and forth about every line, And there was a bit of education going on both sides. I would say much more on my side than on his. But there were certain nuances about country music, that sort of thing. So the way this installation initially took shape was a very simple record player placed inside an empty room, and the song playing on a vinyl record. And looking back, I can honestly say that Mario created a non-site right within the room, almost his own Amarillo ramp or spiral jetty, if you will. That all you had to do is, it was as part of this Biennale exhibit, travel to this location, and you could hear it. You could hear it throughout the building. It didn't really interfere with the other works, but you could, something was beckoning you to this corner, and you got into the room, and there it was the song. So it wasn't so much about me or the song, but it was about Mario and his vision and what he had to say about Smithson. And so what we're here to discuss tonight is about how he's extended and amplified that original piece and his vision to something much broader and something much more kind of along the lines of conceptual art and visual art and visual storytelling.
Yeah, so just to sort of explain what really JD has started to say is the fact that the exhibition here in the museum, it's that. So it's the project that took many years, and it's a long story. started from a song.
Always.
And at some point after some time, I figured that I wanted this song to become part of a larger project. So I ended up last year, I think, ended up making a film, which actually became a sort of road trip, a kind of essay film about the projects that Smithson had planned to do throughout the state of Texas and in the Amarillo Ramp, which is the only work that actually exists in Texas from Smithson and was made after his death. And the exhibition there has a number of elements, but nevertheless, it was very important to invite JD to sort of try to come back to the lyrics, because in a way, I feel like the way that was laid out little by little sort of started to sort of bring about a number of interests that became later on the film and a number of things. One of the other important things to say about the exhibition is the fact that in a way the film claims that even though Smithson never got to realize his visions in the state of Texas, the film claims that they actually exist. And how could we? So the exhibition really is kind of an essay about sort of arguing about that, arguing the fact that the works exist outside the museum. The works exist because they are thoughts independently. Where are they made, or not independently of where they made, but the fact that even though to think about the fact that if there is an idea and there is a place and there is a material still around, we could potentially experience those thoughts, and would that lead us to think farther, starting from Smithson thoughts. So that's really what the exhibition is about. But I don't know, maybe we should, do you happen to have the lyrics of...
JD's song, too, was heard as we all
you said
came
you
into
had
the auditorium.
The lyrics somewhere.
I do, in fact, have the lyrics. we debated whether or not you all, you know, we should bring the lyrics into this, because this isn't about, this is about the current work and about the cinematic duplicity that Smithson himself brought to New York. I mean, the Spiral Jetty is in Salt Lake, Utah, right? But he had to bring that back to New York. And in a way, I would say that's very much what what Mario is doing with the Amarillo Ramp and the exhibition that he has debuting this week. But with that, I'll be very happy to read the lyrics. I do have them, of course. We debated whether or not to read them. You heard the song coming in, and so I would just say about that. So Mario was very specific in his direction. He said he wanted it to sound country. And then I was like, okay, he was like, truck driver, country. And then we kind of dug a little deeper, Amarillo, truck driver, country. So that is my interpretation, our interpretation of Amarillo, truck driver, country, a lot of pedal steel, fiddle, what you heard coming in tonight. But I mentioned earlier, I kind of felt, looking back, the materials that were provided to me were, not working in the autobiographical information of a conceptual artist into a country song. Go. Okay. I do not come from this world. I don't know what you're talking about. Glue pour, right? Mirrors over a crystal lake. This sounds like I get it, but at the same time, I'm not sure I'm buying in. But it didn't matter, right? At the time, the challenge was to write a country song around that. I will say I've come around, thanks to Mario.
You should sing it.
There's a grand piano in the back. I don't know that it would give the same feel. If you want to get a feel for the collaborative partnership that Mario and I have developed, be sure and check out the Moderns Instagram account when you leave here. I think you'll be amused. So I'm going to read this. I'm going to read it a bit like Robert Frost read his poems, though I'm not Robert Frost and this isn't a poem, right? But what I want you to be looking for are places, biographical information about Smithson and his works. And with that, here I go. So again, this is a collaborative effort and, a song. The reason I didn't want to read it is because a song is not a song without the music. Typically, it turns into a kind of a bad poem. There's a difference. Poems are written with a certain lyric and tempo and rhythm in mind, and songs have the music to carry that. But so enough. I read it. As we downed a bottle at the end of the bar, he told me of his life and all about his art. He'd come so far to capture the West, to drag it back east to an exclusive set. He would look for lakes of crystalline salt with mirrors and lenses to reflect it all. Born in North Jersey with a drifter's smile, a camera around his neck, and a killer smile. To shape the land, he took to the air. His faith would return him back down again. He talked about jetties and glue he had poured. He sculpted the land and left the dirt on the floor. His pearl snaps reflected in the Amarillo lights. Though from different worlds, we were friends that night. While 73 saw the kind of drought that turns rocks to dust and lays good men out. Some days you make the work, and other days it makes you. And it's hard to tell when to know which one is true. It's just one of life's little secrets I wish I knew. The years had left me in a different place and time, but the news on the radio struck me blind. The DJ said it happened so fast. The fireball I met had recently crashed on an isolated stretch of I-95. I saw Passaic spread across the sky. I thought about my old friend and wished we could talk. But after last night, Bob was gone, gone, gone. So there you have it. You have Passaic, you have the East, you have the West, you have his works. And to hear me say it may not be as effective as to hear what you heard when you walked in. But, I think again, getting back to the reason why we're here and what you'll see at the Modern, is, you know, that song again has new life in this short film, and it's really nice the way you did it. So maybe we should talk about the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important to it's funny to hear you speak the lyrics, because I mean, there's so many layers. I feel like when I came to, I mean, I feel like now we should really, before we get to the film,
you want to dissect the song?
About...
We can dissect the song.
Yeah,
he and
well,
we dissected every line of that song over "I Am" over the course of a few weeks, and it was really interesting. You know,
but I think what was really important for me in that very same gesture of bringing a story to somebody local, to somebody who knew the language, was the fact that you really sort of brought in a number of stories that are there, like the dust, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
storm,
the dust bowl,
the years, the sort of very specific references to very specific type of country from a very specific time. So these things that you know that they exist, but you're seeing them from far away. And that when you touch base, you say, well, no, this is not said this way, this is said this way, and this actually brings this number of historical references. And I think this is the most important part. I mean, maybe, I don't know, what is it for you guys out here, like, sort of talking about this whole abstraction story, but potentially when you guys hear the song, could all those things will start to coming up, and for me it was very important in that sort of collaborative process.
So, yeah, every line was very intentional. So maybe one of the least sounding intentional lines was about, you know, 73 saw the kind of drought that turns rocks to dust and lays good men out. I mean, the whole time I wrote this song, I was thinking about Amarillo, right? He said that was my direction, was Amarillo. And it's hard to think of Amarillo and Route 66 passed through Amarillo, and it's hard to think of Route 66 without thinking about the Dust Bowl. And it's hard to think about, I want a country song that kind of, you know, pays homage to the genre without, you know, hearkening back to the days of Woody Guthrie, right, and the roots of country music. So for me, this is, you know, every line in here is, you know, it's... yeah, it's a challenge to work in jetties and glue pours. But at the same time, it feels very good to write a line that talks about turning rocks to dust and laying good men out, which essentially is what Amarillo did to so many people, including Smithson. I mean, it's hard country, and it's hard Scrabble country, and it's country that is kind of at the tip. I mean, it's on the... you know, high plains of Texas, but not too far from the Chihuahuan Desert, where, you know, Mario and I both have, you know, kind of roots. And so we both have those West Texas roots. And as we were talking, I think the whole time we were kind of coming at it from that point of view. And, like, you know, Smithson, as Mario alluded to, kind of liked to come play cowboy in the West and then bring that back east. He started regional with New Jersey, and then what I failed to say was that through his movie, The Spiral Jetty, or through other items that he brought back to the east with him, you know, he was always about, you know, creating a dialogue, right, between nature and kind of this physical gallery New York City world, and really encouraging people to get to know nature and get to know, I mean, that was his whole point, was, I mean, I think his whole point was that nature is full of chaos, essentially. But now I'm maybe getting a little too abstract, but...
let's maybe, we have prepared a fraction.
Yeah, I think now's a great time
film.
To show it, yeah.
That we can, I mean, we didn't, it's a film that is 30 minutes, so I didn't want to take all the time to show the film, but we've selected a small fraction so that you have a little bit of a notion of what it is, and maybe we can potentially talk about that afterwards.
And the film will be in the exhibition opening on Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Los días se confabulan una y otra vez para asegurarse de que nunca nos alejemos de su realidad y para asegurarse de que las cosas se pongan tal y como son, siempre por encima de su potencial para ser imaginadas de otra manera. ¿Cuánto dura la vida de un rana?
Se extingue cuando su descarga eléctrica toca tierra o cuando hemos escuchado el sonido desfasado de su trueno. Ciertas visiones, cual relámpagos, solo pueden entenderse una vez que aparecen extintas. Otras veces, pueden pasar años antes de que su dispersión en el tiempo o su propio contexto logre revelarlas ante nosotros. Cuando uno piensa en la imagen histórica de Texas, una película se proyecta ante nosotros. Es el fondo de un dramático largometraje. Este lugar ha sido escenario de múltiples proyectos, de pasados diversos y de un sinfín de futuros, algunos realizados, otros abandonados. Visualizamos Texas a partir de su vasto territorio, pero siempre bajo la amenaza de que el clima tome la delantera, el viento en primer plano, los huracanes que traen consigo inundaciones y los tornados que hacen desaparecer todo lo que encuentran a su paso. En el fondo de la imagen, el calor, que distorsiona nuestra percepción de la verdad. No es difícil entender por qué, a la distancia, Texas suele despertar una gran fascinación. Hasta el día de hoy, esta región sigue remitiendo al viejo oeste. Un paisaje que se le vislumbra capaz de expandir las ideas sobre todas las cosas. Un territorio que promete generosidad, transformación, a cambio de poner la vida en riesgo. Los veranos son cálidos y húmedos por estas latitudes. Cuando se trabaja al aire libre, la atmósfera se percibe a través de corrientes de convección que velan constantemente aquello que algunos llaman objetividad. La roca caliza es una piedra sedimentaria compuesta mayoritariamente por carbonato de calcio que reacciona con efervescencia a la presencia de ácidos. Las calizas se forman en los mares cálidos y poco profundos de las regiones tropicales. El asfalto se encuentra mezclado en el crudo que se produce, también en el interior de la tierra por transformación de la materia orgánica acumulada en los sedimentos del pasado geológico. El tiempo sobre la materia, el calor como escenario del gesto. Planes, visiones, imágenes, existencia. Una sucesión de refracciones de luz que atraviesa distintas densidades de aire. Estas condiciones climatológicas son capaces de producir lo que se abandonó, lo que quedó pendiente. La ilusión no es solo lo que se desea, sino también la interpretación errónea de un estímulo externo. Ver una obra en donde solo hay locación, materiales, ¿no es acaso esto la creación más pura de la obra? El cráter contiene, pero también se convierte en epicentro del desastre, en la encarnación más clara de la evolución de la naturaleza. Primero la del asfalto y luego la del sulfuro. El desbordamiento de Texas, dos veces fechado.
So JD, you kind of picked up on this a little bit in your discussion before, but I wanted to ask you both, the film is a lot about Texas, almost as much as it is about Smithson. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, yes, it is a kind of being a road trip. It's in a way my take on Texas, or one take that I could think of Texas. And what I was saying before is the fact that and as JD was saying also, I grew up in the north of Mexico, and I have during my teenage years and as a kid, I spent a lot of time in Texas. And so in that sense, is that's sort of the reason why I thought I could actually allow myself to do this film and sort of make such a claim, and the claim that uses the Texas weather and the Texas subjectivity with a number of other elements to try to claim that those works actually exist. And it's through that claim that one has a kind of a specific view about Texas. And so I don't know. Portrays a Texas as a natural, faraway place, still a kind of a place of possibilities, but also a kind of almost like a dreamy place, a place that allows for visions and things to happen. So I think, in a kind of a poetic term, that is something that has been in my work for a number of years. One could make the argument that idea of thinking far away can make things happen.
And in your thinking and in your background, Texas isn't ever too far away, correct?
Yeah, it's not far away. It's very close, but in a sense, it feels like that place where you could actually live. It's a place where land is vast, and is in that moment potentially. Is that very same gesture that Smithson was doing to go far away from his home, to go where there is no people, where things happen. So that's, in that sense, that's how I mentioned. That's how I imagine this faraway place, even though it's close. We're here.
Ironically, you and I have done kind of the opposite of what Smithson did, right? Went from small towns to big cities. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Here we are, just having a conversation, cowboys. Right? Talking about cowboys.
I should say, I feel like we haven't talked that much about what you guys will see in the exhibition. I should say that I was very happy when you invited me to show this piece. I made this piece last year, and when you came about, when I came with the idea of showing it here, I was really excited, because I knew that the museum had some of the sketches that Smithson had made for those projects. So it was really, for me, it's very important to show the piece here, not just because it feels very close to home in a way. It's like sharing these thoughts with you guys, that I in a way feel close and feel familial, but also the fact that there was a second aura, which was this to have been able to show this essay along the original drawings of Smithson. So in that sense, I feel like my own position as an artist, I like to challenge myself in that way, sort of to put myself in a position where my work is not just what I have to say, but to become a sort of platform where a number of things can coincide and create something else. So in that sense, I'm very happy and grateful to be able to show the piece along the Smithson drawings and a number of other objects that you will see in the exhibition. But hopefully that completes this essay.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about the significance of showing your sketches and models in this format?
Yeah, so the exhibition, you will see it will contain the film and the Smithson drawings, and also will show a number of other objects that can potentially tell the story that we've been discussing here. One of the first elements that you will see will be the stamper, the plate, the mold for the first record we made that was shown in Dallas. And so in that sense, that kind of will start potentially drawing this, not only the works, but not only this sort of final work or the song itself, but the fact that it will imply that every work of art has a story and tells a story of its own, and that sort of logic has a number of things to say throughout it. So I've decided to show the stamper that we produced the first record with, and I will show also a number of sketches that I had made to construct the film, with the idea of also sort of blurring the lines between what works are made and what not, and sort of flatten out this idea that only final works have a meaning, but all the discussions and the negotiations that one does through that process bring up a number of questions and meanings potentially.
Which relate to the airport drawings and how that project wasn't actually realized, but...
Exactly. So in that same sense, so it's sort of thinking about the fact that even if some works were not made, some thoughts that are in my own drawings that might not be ended up in the film, they still have a number of thoughts the same way that Smithson drawings can bring us to a number of places.
And I think with your visual storytelling in the film, what we just saw was, you know, I mean, similar to what we do in songwriting, and I mean, you didn't say it, but Smithson spent a lot of time in rock quarries. As it happens in Rome, where Clint Eastwood would shoot his spaghetti westerns in Italy because it looked very much like Texas, and where Smithson did his asphalt pours, right? And so here you are in the rock quarry. You don't show an asphalt pour, but it's very definitely in my mind an homage to you're actually, you know, kind of calling that to mind, right? The rock pours that he did in the rock quarry or asphalt pours. I mean, you do talk about asphalt, so it's hinted at.
That's really interesting that you say that. This the spaghetti westerns he went to. I mean, he went to a number of places, but he did piece in Rome. And what the film pretends to imagine or to have people imagine is the fact that one could potentially experience the works of Smithson through going through the places where he could have find the material to do it, or the places where he wanted to locate the works, and how that sort of imagination could make you leave the museum as well, same way that he was leaving the gallery from New York to come to this way. If you potentially leave the museum or conceive the museum as something that is extended and not doesn't exist just physically and geographically in a place, but can be extended to a number of places, you could also, with the drawings in the hand or with the image of the drawings in the hand, you could go to the place and experience these pieces. So that's why the character in the film goes to the quarry and a number of places, the airport, and ends actually in Amarillo, where the ramp is.
We're about out of time, so I don't know if you guys are ready to open it up to the audience, but if anybody has any questions, feel free to ask.
I'm happy to answer.
I had a couple questions. First, I was curious if his films, Spiral City and Mono Lake, were at all influential. They seem to be very influential to the film you made. And then I was curious about the text that you have your character reciting during the film, because it sounded a lot like what you might read of Smithson's. Also, you mention Texas overflow in Asphalt and in Limestone and Sulfur, right? Which were actually two projects he proposed in Texas as well. So I was curious about those two things.
Repeat the question.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm going to attempt to repeat the question for the simulcast and for the YouTube, if I may. So the question is what influence did Smithson's films have on your film? They seem very thematically similar. The materials and the asphalt and the sulfur and the limestone that Texas has in place, and also about the script seems very influenced by Smithson's scripts in that essay narrative, almost poetic essay approach that you took.
Yeah, definitely. I think when I I could potentially make a film out of that. You have to ask yourself, how do you go about it? I had made a number of films, and I was a little bit thinking that most of my films were very text based, and they explain a lot of things. And sort of thinking about that, and sort of going back through Smithson's writings, I could sort of hint at the fact that, you know, he had this hard to say poetic but sort of abstract way of writing. So sort of there was almost this kind of atmospheric feeling to his writings. And so in a way I was sort of trying to learn from that and sort of figure out how to build a film that didn't claim such things in a very direct way or a very kind of directorial way, but through atmosphere. So this clip that you saw is actually one of the most text dense part of it. And so I sort of started thinking how to, in the same way as Smithson had built his films, also like sort of in a way documenting a work, but at the same time sort of throwing in a number of information about geology or ecology or whatever, and how that sort of informed the piece. And I think not only has he been influential in this film, but in other films I made, in the fact that even though one might end up using a number of cinematic tropes or cinematic language, nevertheless the work, or I feel like the work of an artist, the genealogy of those things actually do not come from film history, but from history of documenting works and documenting gestures. And so it's in that sense that I feel like this film is constructed. How do we make a documentary or the document of a gesture? How do one documents that gesture? But how do we pass that and sort of inform that and sort of and almost embed it with the thoughts that you had through it? So that's what this text is about. And of course the language is very much flirts with the way that Smithson was writing, definitely.
And the materials were not dismissed in the asphalt, the calcium, the limestone.
And yeah, the materials, of course, come from those two versions of Texas overflow. But at the same way, I feel like that I couldn't claim that those works are in that specific place. But the question was how to figure out how to mention those things, those sketches, in a more or less abstract way, to sort of call them, but in a very atmospheric way. How could we have people imagine that those works exist through an atmospheric language, let's say? And yeah, that's.
Let me hand you this. I don't. This gets it? Okay, great.
But that was trying to
sure. So you spoke at length about the kind of disconnect between what an artist does as his work and his actions, and the historical sort of construction of that artist also as a character or figure. Your work, since it so often deals with past conceptual artists, is there room for history to create a character of you as an artist?
I love that question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have recently realized that I have built a character already of myself. But it's very difficult for me to know that if that character is truthful or not.
Who is the real Mario?
Exactly.
Are you PRing yourself?
I tell you a very, very nice story. I mean, the fact that I enjoy it. And it's the fact that I recently, or a year ago or so, I had this show in Dublin. And the curator there had a small piece of a small gallery, but she wanted to show more works than she could put in that gallery. So we ended up deciding that we wanted to, we will change the works every week or every 2 weeks, I can't remember. But last minute, before the exhibition opened, we had a gallery talk. And last minute, we decided that we wanted to talk about the works that were not still there as if they were there. So we started talking about, you know, in present tense, like, you know, we talk about the works that were there, and then suddenly we started saying, like, you know, this piece that you see here, blah, 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 this is the title. And it all came out very naturally for some reason. And then a week later, she calls me back and she says, you know what, they say that the guy who was here was not you. And I, of course, you know, don't mess up with that gossip. I love it. You know, I think it's, for me, it's very interesting that I hope that I at least not just become a character, but at least become a multitude of characters, because I have a very problematic relationship to that. I think the only way to sort of fight history is at least to sort of multiply that and at least be a number of characters and not just one.
Can I add on what I've seen in working with Mario, do you mind, as part of answering your question, is that it's interesting as Mario studies these other conceptual artists and draws his inspiration from them, I see something different. And what that looks like is Mario kind of steps into the background and lets the work and the artist that he is focusing on kind of move to the foreground. So it's the case with the exhibition that you'll see here. It's the case with the first exhibition, which, by the way, was, you know, it was there and then gone, right? I mean, it existed only for so long as the needle was on the record, and then it was gone. I don't know where those records are. I'd like to have a copy if you have one. But what I see is Mario stepping to the background. So, you know, it's all joking aside, I think that the Mario kind of is becoming like this character. And, you know, it's I think he's doing a very intentional, even if it doesn't know it yet, job of ensuring that that doesn't happen and get in the way of his work.
Terry?
Could you talk a little bit about the way that you work with what I'm sort of identifying as being almost kind of archetypes or, you know, like the record. You put all of these components in this space. And then it almost, you know, it might to somebody walking in off the street seem like that this added to this added to this is supposed to bring everybody to the same conclusion. But in fact, it doesn't. Can you talk a little bit about the ambiguity that plays a role in how the participant, how the viewer is going to create their own experience in a way?
I mean, I guess one through, I mean, I could only answer that through, not to be selfish, but through my own history, and is the fact that, you know, little by little one goes making a number of decisions throughout the career. And this is something, it's nice that you bring it up, because it's a decision that I made lately. I mean, I think that if I may sort of draw a little bit quick history about that, I think that when I felt that some of the sort of more concrete works I made, one of the important decisions about them was the fact that I started to use film, and not only film, like I was using a lot of slideshows, and that had to do with the decision of telling a story and figuring out how to tell a story that was really my relationship to a specific art historical chapter, but to do it through a cinematic space. And I figured out that cinematic space was very important for me because it, in relation to other art historians, I had to find my place. How do I, as an artist, could tell a story that was not meant to be written in stone, was not meant to even be written in a book, but to have a space where that fiction was in a space where things could be fiction and where things could be movable and could be questioned. And throughout that, I sort of started getting into sort of more argumentative works where I use a lot of text, and until a degree that I started thinking like, well, this film is in the fact that it was decided to become more atmospherical was a step in that. And the show itself here is sort of radicalizing a little bit more, because I don't want my thoughts or my the story that I have to share to be written in stone, but I don't want to be the only one talking about it, but to have space for that to have echoes. So in that sense, that's why potentially that gallery space will talk in different ways to different people, and people can navigate it in a different way, and it's not just me, but Smithson and potentially JD and a number of other things. Actually, I should mention that the one other thing behind the sketches of the film I made, there's also a piece by an early discussion sketch, which is in music is called Demo, that will be also be shown in the gallery. So in terms of sound, you will see the film, and at some point when the film ends, you will hear JD singing a very early version of the song, which is a more down tempo version of the country song you were listening. So in that sense, also kind of sort of extending those possibilities and extending the fact that we could potentially keep working on that song or keep working on a different song. Or
that's what I was just joking about with him, Terry, after your question, is that stay tuned, we're not done, you know. Who knows where the next exhibition will be, and and what form that will take.
Does that seem like a good place to...
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for staying. Thank you.